When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Chapter 10 of The Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 10. Beyond this, Menlik worked his way to the very lip of a drop, raising a finger cautiously. Beyond this, we do not go. But you say that the camp of your people lies well out in the plains. Jil Lee was up on one knee, using the field glasses they had brought from the stores of the wrecked ship. He passed them along to Travis. There was nothing to be sighted but the rippling amber waves of the tall grasses, save for an occasional break of a copse of trees near the foothills. They had reached this point in the early morning, threading through the pass, making their way across the section known to the outlaws. From here they could survey the debatable land where their temporary allies insisted the Reds were in full control. The result of the conference in the south had been this uneasy alliance. From the start, Travis realized that he could not hope to commit the clan to any set plan, that even to get this scouting party to come against the stubborn resistance of Deklay and his reactionaries was a major achievement. There was now an opening wedge of six Apaches in the north. Beyond this, Menlik repeated, they keep watch and can control us with the caller. What do you think? Travis passed the glasses to Nolan. If they were ever to develop a war chief, this lean man, tall for an Apache and slow to speak, might fill that role. He adjusted the lenses and began a detailed study sweep of the open territory. Then he stiffened. His mouth, below the masking of the glasses, was tight.
"What is it?" Jil Lee asked.
"Riders. 2, 4, 5. Also something else. In the air."
Menlik jerked back and grabbed at Nolan's arm, dragging him down by the weight of his body.
"The flyer! Come back! Back!"
He was still pulling at Nolan, prodding at Travis with one foot, and the Apache stared at him with amazement. The shaman sputtered in his own language, and then, visibly regaining command of himself, spoke English once more.
"Those are hunters, and they carry a caller. Either some others have escaped, or they are determined to find our mountain camp."
Jil Lee looked at Travis.
"You did not feel anything when the woman was under that spell?"
Travis shook his head.
Jil Lee nodded and then said to the shaman, "We shall stay here and watch, but since it is bad for you, do you go, and we shall meet you near this place of the towers. Agreed?"
For a moment Menlik's face held a shadowy expression Travis tried to read. Was it resentment, resentment that he was forced to retreat when the others could stand their ground? Did the Tatar believe that he lost face this way? But the shaman gave a grunt of what they took as assent and slipped over the edge of the lookout point. A moment later they'd heard him speaking the Mongol tongue, warning Huligar and Lachu, his companions on the scout. Then came the clatter of pony hoofs as they rode their mounts away. The Apache settled back in the cup, which gave them a wide view over the plains. Soon it was not necessary to use the glasses in order to sight the advancing party of hunters. Five riders, four wearing Tatar dress. The fifth had such an odd outline that Travis was reminded of Menlik's sketch of the alien. Under the sharper vision of the glasses, he saw that the rider was equipped with a pack strapped between his shoulders and a bulbous helmet covering most of his head. Highly specialized equipment for communication, Travis guessed.
"That is a copter up above," Nolan said. "Different shape from ours."
They had been familiar with helicopters back on Terra. Ranchers used them for range inspection, and all of the Apache volunteers had flown in them. But Nolan was correct. This one possessed several unfamiliar features.
"The Tatars said they don't bring those very far into the mountains," Jill Lee mused.
"That could explain their man on horseback. He gets in where they don't fly."
Nolan fingered his bow.
"If these Reds depend upon their machine to control what they seek, then they may be taken by surprise."
"But not yet." Travis spoke sharply. Nolan frowned at him.
Jill Lee chuckled. "The way is not so dark for us, younger brother, that we need your torch held for our feet."
Travis swallowed back any retort, accepting the fairness of that rebuke. He had no right to believe that he alone knew the best way of handling the enemy. Biting on the sourness of that realization, he lay quietly with the others, watching the riders enter the foothills perhaps a quarter of a mile to the west. The helicopter was circling now over the men riding into a cut between two rises. When they were lost to view, the pilot made wider casts, and Travis thought the flyer's crew were probably in communication with the helmeted one of the quintet on the ground. He stirred.
"They're heading for the Tatar camp, just as if they know exactly where it is."
"That also may be true," Nolan replied. "What do we know of these Tatars? They have freely said that the Reds can hold them in mine ropes when they wish. Already they may be so bound. I say, let us go back to our own country."
He added to the decisiveness of that by handing Jill Lee the glasses and sliding down from their perch.
Travis looked at the other. In a way, he could understand the wisdom of Nolan's suggestion, but he was sure that the withdrawal now would only postpone trouble. Sooner or later, the Apaches would have to stand against the Reds, and if they could do that now while the enemy was occupied with trouble from the Tatars, so much the better.
Jill Lee was following Nolan, but something in Travis rebelled. He watched the circling helicopter. If it was overhanging the action area of the horsemen, they had either reined in or were searching a relatively small section of the foothills. Reluctantly, Travis descended to the hollow where Jill Lee stood with Nolan. Tsoe and Lupe and Rope were a little to one side, as if the final orders would come from their seniors.
"It would be well," Jill Lee said slowly, "if we saw what weapons they have. I want a closer look at the equipment of that one in the helmet. Also," he smiled straight at Nolan, "I do not think that they can detect the presence of warriors of the people unless we will it so."
Nolan ran a finger along the curve of his bow, shot a measuring glance right and left at the general contours of the country.
"There is wisdom in what you say, elder brother. Only this is a trail we shall take alone, not allowing the men with fur hats to know where we walk."
He looked pointedly in Travis' direction.
"That is wisdom, Ba'ise," Travis promptly replied, giving Nolan the old title accorded the leader of a war party. Travis was grateful for that much of a concession. They swung into action, heading southeast at an angle which should bring them across the track of the enemy hunting party. The path was theirs at last, only moments after the passing of their quarry. None of the five riders was taking any precautions to cover his trail. Each moved with the confidence of one not having to fear any attack. From cover, the Apaches looked aloft. They could hear the faint hum of the helicopter. It was still circling, Tsoe reported from a higher checkpoint, but those circles remained close over the plains area. The riders had already passed beyond the limits of that aerial sentry. Three to a side, the Apaches advanced with the trail between them. They were carefully hidden when they caught up with the hunters. The four Tatars were grouped together. The fifth man,
heavily burdened by his pack, had climbed from the saddle and was sitting on the ground, his hands busy with a flat plate which covered him from upper chest to belt. Now that he had a chance to see them closely, Travis noted the lack of expression on the broad Tatar faces. The four men were blank of eye, astride their mounts with no apparent awareness of their present surroundings. Then, as one, their heads swung around to the helmeted leader, before they dismounted and stood motionless for a long moment, in a way which reminded Travis of the coyote's attitude when they endeavored to pass some message to him. But these men even lacked the signs of thinking intelligence the animals had. The helmeted man's hand moved across his chest plate, and instantly his followers came into a measure of life. One put his hand to his forehead with an odd, half-dazed gesture. Another half-crouched, his lips wrinkling back in a snarl. And the leader, watching him, laughed. Then he snapped an order, his hand poised over his control plate. One of the four took the horse reins, made the mounts fast to nearby bushes. Then, as one, they began to walk forward, the red bringing up the rear several paces behind the nearest Tatar. They were going upslope to the crest of a small ridge. The Tatar who first reached the crest put his hands to cup his mouth, sent a ringing cry southward, and the faint "hoo, hoo, hoo" echoed on and on through the hills. Either Menlik had reached the camp in time, or his people were not to be so easily enticed. For though the hunters waited for a long time, there was no answer to that hail. At last the helmeted man called his captives, bringing them sullenly down to mount and ride again, a move which suited the Apaches. They could not tell how close was the communication between the rider and the helicopter, and they were still too near the plains to attack unless it was necessary for their own protection. Travis dropped back to join Nolan. "He controls them by that plate on his chest," he said. "If we would take them, we must get at that." "These Tatars use lariats in fighting. Did they not rope you as a calf is roped for branding? Then why do they not so take this red, binding his arms to his sides?" The suspicion in Nolan's voice was plain. "Perhaps in them is some conditioned control, making it so they cannot attack their rulers." "I do not like this matter of machines which can play this way and that with minds and bodies," flared Nolan. "A man should only use a weapon, not be one." Travis could agree to that. Had they not, by the wreck of their own ship and the death of Ruthven, escaped just such an existence as these Tatars now endured? If so, why? He and all the Apaches were volunteers, eager and willing to form new world colonies. What had happened back on Terra that they had been so ruthlessly sent out without warning and under redax? Another small piece of that puzzle, or maybe the heart of the whole picture, snapped into place. Had the project learned in some way of the Tatar settlement on Topaz, and so been forced to speed up that translation from late 20th century Americans to primitives? That would explain a lot. Travis returned abruptly to the matter now at hand as he saw a peak ahead. The party they were trailing was heading directly for the outlaw hideout. Travis hoped Menlik had warned them in time. There, that wall of cliff to his left must shelter the Valley of the Towers, though it was still miles ahead. Travis did not believe the hunters would be able to reach their goal unless they traveled at night. They might not know of the ape things which could menace the dark. But the enemy, whether he knew of such dangers or not, did not intend to press on. As the sun pulled away, leaving crevices and crannies shadow dark, the hunters stopped to make camp. The Apaches, after their custom on the war trail, gathered on the heights above. "This red seems to think that he shall find those he seeks sitting, waiting for him, as if their feet were nipped tight in a trap," Tsoe remarked. "It is the habit of the Pinda Lik Oyi," Lupi added, "to believe they are greater than all others. Yet this one is a stupid fool, walking into the arms of a she-bear with a cub," he chuckled. "A man with a rifle does not fear a man armed only with a stick," Travis cut in quickly. "This one is armed with a weapon which he has good reason to believe makes him invulnerable to attack. If he rests tonight, he probably leaves his machine on guard." "At least we are sure of one thing," Nolan said in half-agreement. "This one does not suspect that there are any in these hills save those he can master, and his machine does not work against us. Thus, at dawn," he made a swift gesture, and they smiled in concert. At dawn, the old time of attack. An Apache does not attack at night. Travis was not sure that any of them could break that old taboo and creep down upon the camp before the coming of new light. But tomorrow morning they would take over this confident Red, strip him of his enslaving machine. Travis' head jerked. It had come as suddenly as a blow between his eyes, to half stun him. What was it? Not any physical impact. No, something which was dazing but still immaterial. He braced his whole body, awaiting its return, trying frantically to understand what had happened in that instant of vertigo and seeming disembodiment. Never had he experienced anything like it. Or had he? 2 years or more ago, when he had gone through the time transfer to enter the Arizona of the Folsom men, some 10,000 years earlier, that moment of transfer had been something like this, a sensation of being awry in space and time with no stable footing to be found. Yet he was lying here on very tangible rock and soil, and nothing about him in the shadow-hung landscape of Topaz had changed in the slightest. But that blow had left behind a quivering residue of panic buried far inside him, a tender spot like an open wound. Travis drew a deep breath which was almost a sob, levered himself up on one elbow to stare intently down into the enemy camp. Was this some attack from the other's unknown weapon? Suddenly he was not at all sure what might happen when the Apaches made that dawn rush. Jill Lee was in station on his right. Travis must compare notes with him to be sure that this was not indeed a trap. Better to retreat now than to be taken like a fish in a net. He crept out of his place, gave the chittering signal call of the fluff ball, and heard Jill Lee's answer in a cleverly mimicked trill of a night insect. "Did you feel something just now in your head?" Travis found it difficult to put that sensation into words. "Not so, but you did?" He had. Of course he had. The remains of it were still in him, that point of panic. "Yes." "The machine?" "I don't know." Travis' confusion grew. It might be that he alone of the party had been struck. If so, he could be a danger to his own kind. "This is not good. I think we had better hold counsel away from here." Jill Lee's whisper was the merest ghost of sound. He chirped again to be answered from Tsoe upslope, who passed on the signal. The first moon was high in the sky as the Apaches gathered together. Again Travis asked his question, had any of the others felt that odd blow? He was met by negatives. But Nolan had the final word. "This is not good," he echoed Jill Lee's comment. "If it was the Red Machine at work, then we may all be swept into this net along with those he seeks. Perhaps the longer one remains close to that thing, the more influence it gains over him. We shall stay here until dawn. If the enemy would reach the place they seek, then they must pass below us, for that is the easiest road. Burdened with his machine, that Red has ever taken the easiest way. So we shall see if he also has a defense against these when they come without warning." He touched the arrows in his quiver. To kill from ambush meant that they might never learn the secret of the machine, but after his experience Travis was willing to admit that Nolan's caution was the wise way. Travis wanted no part of a second attack like that which had shaken him so, and Nolan had not ordered a general retreat. It must be in the War Chief's thoughts, as it was in Travis, that if the machine could have an influence over Apaches, it must cease to function. They set their ambush with the age-old skill the Redax had grafted into their memories. Then there was nothing to do but wait. It was an hour after dawn when Soe signaled that the enemy was coming, and shortly after they heard the thud of ponies' hoofs. The first Tatar plodded into view, and by the stance of his body in the saddle, Travis knew the Red had him under full control. Two, then three Tatars passed between the teeth of the Apache trap. The fourth one had allowed a wider gap to open between himself and his fellows. Then the Red leader came. His face below the bulge of the helmet was not happy. Travis believed the man was not a horseman by inclination. The Apache set arrow to bow cord, and at the chirp from Nolan, fired in concert with his clansmen. Only one of those arrows found a target. The Red's pony gave a shrill scream of pain and terror, reared, pawing at the air, toppled back, pinning its shouting rider under it. The Red had had a defense right enough, one which had somehow deflected the arrows. But he neither had protection against his own awkward seat in the saddle, nor the arrow which had seriously wounded the now threshing pony. Ahead the Tatars twisted and writhed, mouthed tortured cries, then dropped out of their saddles to lie limply on the ground, as if the arrows aimed at the master had instead struck each to the heart. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of The Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 11. Either the Red was lucky or his reactions were quick. He had somehow rolled clear of the struggling horse as Loopy leapt from behind a boulder, knife out and ready. To the eyes of the Apaches, the helmeted man lay easy prey to Loopy's attack. Nor did he raise an arm to defend himself, though one hand lay free across the plate on his chest. But the young Apache stumbled, rebounding back as if he had run into an unseen wall, when his knife was still 6 inches away from the other. Loopy cried out, shook under a second impact, as the Red fired an automatic with his other hand. Travis dropped his bow, returned to the most primitive weapon of all. His hand closed around a stone, and he hurled the fist-sized oval straight at the helmet so clearly outlined against the rocks below. But even as Loopy's knife had never touched flesh, so was the rock deflected. The Red was covered by some protective field. This was certainly nothing the Apaches had seen before. Nolan's whistle summoned them to draw back. The Red fired again, the sharp bark of the handgun harsh and loud. He did not have any real target, for with the exception of Loopy, the Apaches had gone to earth. Between the rocks the Red was struggling to his feet, but he moved slowly, favoring his side and one leg. He had not come totally unharmed from his tumble with the pony. An armed enemy who could not be touched, one who knew there were more than outlaws in this region. The Red leader was far more of a threat to the Apaches now than he had ever been. He must not be allowed to escape. He was holstering his gun, moving along with one hand against the rocks to steady himself, trying to reach one of the ponies that stood with trailing reins beside the inert Tatars. But when the enemy reached the far side of that rock, he would have to sacrifice either his steadying hold or his touch on the chest plate where his other hand rested. Would he then, for an instant, be vulnerable? The pony! Travis put an arrow on bow cord and shot. Not at the Red, who had released his hold of the rock, preferring to totter instead of lose control of the chest plate, but into the air straight before the nose of the mount. The pony neighed wildly, tried to turn, and its shoulder caught the free, groping hand of the red and spun the man around and back, so that he flung up both hands in an effort to ward himself off the rocks. Then the pony stampeded down the break, its companions catching the same fever, trailing in a mad dash which kept the red hard against the boulders. He continued to stand there until the horses, save for the wounded one still kicking fruitlessly, were gone. Travis felt a sense of reprieve. They might not be able to get at the red, but he was hurt and afoot, two strikes which might yet reduce him to a condition the Apaches could handle. Apparently the other was also aware of that, for now he pushed out from the rocks and stumbled along after the ponies. But he went only a step or two. Then, settling back once more against a convenient boulder, he began to work at the plate on his chest. Nolan appeared noiselessly beside Travis. "What does he do?" His lips were very close to the younger man's ear, his voice hardly more than a breath. Travis shook his head slightly. The Red's actions were a complete mystery. Unless, now disabled and afoot, he was trying to summon aid, though there was no landing place for a helicopter here. Now was the time to try and reach Loopy. Travis had seen a slight movement in the fallen Apache's hand, the first indication that the enemy's shot had not been as fatal as it had looked. He touched Nolan's arm, pointed to Loopy, and then, discarding his bow and quiver beside the war leader, he stripped for action. There was cover down to the wounded Apache which would aid him. He must pass one of the Tatars on the way, but none of the tribesmen had shown any signs of life since they had fallen from their saddles at the first attack. With infinite care, Travis lowered himself into a narrow passage, took a lizard's way between brush and boulder, pausing only when he reached the Tatar for a quick check on the potential enemy. The lean brown face was half turned, one cheek in the sand, but the slack mouth, the closed eyes, were those, Travis believed, of a dead man. By some action of his diabolic machine, the Red must have snuffed out his four captives, perhaps in the belief that they were part of the Apache attack. Travis reached the rock where Loopy lay. He knew that Nolan was watching the Red and would give him warning if he suddenly showed an interest in anything but his machine. The Apache reached out, his hands closing on Loopy's ankles. Beneath his touch, flesh and muscle tensed. Loopy's eyes were open, focused now on Travis. There was a bleeding furrow above his right ear. The Red had tried a difficult head shot, failing in his aim by a mere fraction of an inch. Loopy made a swift move for which Travis was ready. His grip on the other's body helped to tumble them both around a rock which lay between them and the Red. There was a crack of another shot, and dust spurted from the side of the boulder. But they lay together, safe for the present, as Travis was sure the enemy would not risk an open attack on their small fortress. With Travis' aid, Loopy struggled back up to the site where Nolan waited. Jill Lee was there to make competent examination of the boy's wound. "Creased," he reported. "A sore head, but no great damage. Perhaps a scar later, warrior." He gave Loopy an encouraging thump on the shoulder before plastering an aid pack over the cut. "Now we go," Nolan spoke with emphatic decision. "He saw enough of us to know we are not Tatars." Nolan's eyes were cold, his mouth grim, as he faced Travis. "And how can we fight him?" "There is a wall you cannot see about him," Loopy broke in. "When I would strike at him, I could not." "A man with invisible protection and a gun." Jill Lee took up the argument. "How would you deal with him, younger brother?" "I don't know," Travis admitted. Yet he also believed that if they withdrew, left the Red here to be found by his own people, the enemy would immediately begin an investigation of the southern country. Perhaps, pushed by their need for learning more about the Apaches, they would bring the helicopter in over the mountains. The answer to all Apache dangers for now lay in the immediate future of this one man.
"He is hurt. He cannot go far on foot.
and even if he calls the copter, there is no landing place. He will have to move elsewhere to be picked up. Travis thought aloud, citing the thin handful of points in their favor.
Rocks up there, and rocks can roll. Start an earth slide.
Something within Travis balked at that. From the first, he had been willing enough to slug it out with the Red, weapon to weapon, man to man. Also, he had wanted to take a captive, not stand over a body. But to use the nature of the country against the enemy, that was the oldest Apache trick of all, and one they would have to be forced to employ. Nolan had already nodded in assent, and Soe and Jil Lee started off. Even if the Red did possess a protective wall device, could it operate in full against a landslide? They all doubted that. The Apaches reached the cliff rim without exposing themselves to the enemy's fire. The Red still sat there calmly, his back against the rock, his hands busy with his equipment, as if he had all the time in the world. Then suddenly came a scream from more than one throat.
"Dar Ugar!"
the ancient war cry of the Mongol hordes. Then over the lip of the other slope rose a wave of men, their curved swords out, a glazed set to their eyes, heading for the Amerindians with utter disregard for any personal safety. Menlik in the lead, his shaman's robe flapping wide below his belt like the wings of some oversized predatory bird.
"Hulagur, Jagatai, men from the outlaws' camp.
And they were not striving to destroy their disabled overlord in the vale below, but to wipe out the Apaches." Only the fact that the Apaches were already sheltered behind the rocks they were laboring to dislodge gave them a precious few moments of grace. There was no time to use their bows. They could only use knives to meet the swords of the Tatars, knives and the fact that they could fight with unclouded minds.
"He has them under control." Travis pawed at Jilly's shoulder. "Get him! They'll stop!"
He did not wait to see if the other Apache understood. Instead, he threw the full force of his own body against the rock they had made the center stone of their slide. It gave, rolled, carrying with it and before it the rest of the piled rubble. Travis stumbled, fell flat, and then a body thudded down upon him, and he was fighting for his life to keep a blade from his throat. Around him were the shouts and cries of embroiled warriors. Then all was silenced by a roar from below. Glazed eyes in a face only a foot from his own, the twisted, panting mouth sending gusts of breath into his nostrils. Suddenly, there was reason back in those eyes, a bewilderment, which became fear, panic. The Tatar's body twisted in Travis' hold, striving now not to attack, but to win free. As the Apache loosened his grip, the other jerked away, so that for a moment or two they lay gasping side by side. Men sat up to look at men. There was a spreading stain down Jil Lee's side, and one of the Tatars sprawled near him, both his hands on his chest, coughing violently. Menlik clawed at the trunk of a wind-twisted mountain tree, pulled himself to his feet, and stood swaying as might a man long ill and recovering from severe exertion. Insensibly, both sides drew apart, leaving a space between Tatar and Apache. The faces of the Amerindians were grim, those of the Mongols bewildered, and then harsh as they eyed their late opponents with dawning reason. What had begun in compulsion for the Tatars might well flare now into rational combat, and from that into a campaign of extermination. Travis was on his feet. He looked over the lip of the drop. The Red was still in his place down there, a pile of rubble about him. His protection must have failed, for his head was back at an unnatural angle and the dent in his helmet could be easily seen.
"That one is dead or helpless," Travis cried out. "Do you still wish to fight for him, Shaman?"
Menlik came away from the tree and walked to the edge of the crop. The others, too, were moving forward. After the shaman looked down, he stooped, picked up a small stone, and flung it at the motionless Red. There was a crack of sound. they all saw the tiny spurt of flame, a curl of smoke from the plate on the red's chest. Not only the man, but his control was finished now. A wolfish growl, and two of the Tatars swung over, started down to the red. Menlik shouted, and they slackened pace.
"We want that!" he cried in English. "Perhaps so we can learn!"
"The learning is yours," Jil-Lee replied, "just as this land is yours, Shaman. But I warn you, from this day do not ride south."
Menlik turned, the charms on his belt clicking.
"So that is the way it is to be, Apache?"
"That is the way it shall be, Tatar. We do not ride to war with allies who may turn their knives against our backs because they are slaves to a machine the enemy controls."
The Tatar's long, slender-fingered hands opened and closed.
"You are a wise man, Apache, but sometimes more than wisdom alone is needed."
"We are wise men, Shaman. Let it rest there," Jil-Lee replied somberly.
Already the Apaches were on their way, putting two cliff ridges behind them before they halted to examine and cover their wounds.
"We go,"
Nolan's chin lifted, indicating the southern route.
"Here we do not come again. There is too much witchcraft in this place."
Travis stirred, saw that Jil-Lee was frowning at him.
"Go?" he repeated.
"Yes, younger brother. You would continue to run with those who are governed by a machine?"
"No, only eyes are needed on this side of the mountains."
"Why?"
This time Jil-Lee was plainly on the side of the conservatives.
"We have now seen this machine at work. It is fortunate that the Red is dead. He will carry no tales of us back to his people as you feared. Thus, if we remain south from now on, we are safe. And this fight between Tatar and Red is none of ours. What do you seek here?"
"I must go again to the place of the towers," Travis answered with the truth. But his friends were facing him with heavy disapproval, now a full row of Deklays.
"Did you not tell us that you felt this strange thing during the night we waited about the camp? What if you become one with these Tatars and are also controlled by the machine? Then you too can be made into a weapon against us, your clansmen."
Jil-Lee was almost openly hostile. Sense was on his side. But in Travis was this other desire of which he was becoming more conscious by the minute. There was a reason for those towers, perhaps a reason important enough for him to discover and run the risk of angering his own people.
"There may be this." Nolan's voice was remote and cold. "You may already be a piece of this thing, bound to the machines. If so, we do not want you among us."
There it was, an open hostility with more power behind it than Deklay's motiveless disapproval had carried. Travis was troubled. The family, the clan, they were important. If he took the wrong step now and was outlawed from that tight fortress, then, as an Apache, he would indeed be a lost man. In the past of his people there had been renegades from the tribe, men such as the infamous Apache Kid, who had killed and killed again not only white men but his own people, wolf men living wolves' lives in the hills. Travis was threatened with that. Yet up the ladder of civilization, down the ladder, why did this feverish curiosity ride him so cruelly now?
"Listen," Jil-Lee, his side padded with bandages, stepped closer. "And tell me, younger brother, what is it that you seek in these towers?"
On another world there were secrets of the Old Ones to be found in such ancient buildings. Here that might also be true.
"And among the secrets of those Old Ones," Nolan's voice was still harsh, "were those which brought us to this world, is that not so?"
"Did any man drive you, Nolan, or you, Tsoe, or you, Jil-Lee, or any of us, to promise to go beyond the stars? You were told what might be done, and you were eager to try it. You were all volunteers." save for this voyage, when we were told nothing," Jil Lee answered, cutting straight to the heart of the matter. "Yet, Nolan, I do not believe that it is for more voyage tapes that our younger brother now searches, nor would those do us any good, as our ship will not rise again from here. What is it that you do seek?"
"Knowledge. Weapons, maybe. Can we stand against these machines of the Reds? Yet many of the devices they now use are taken from the starships they have looted through time. To every weapon there is a defense."
Nolan blinked, and for the first time a hint of interest touched the mask of his face. "To the bow, the rifle," he said softly. "To the rifle, the machine gun. To the cannon, the big bomb. The defense can be far worse than the first weapon." "So you think that in these towers there may be things which shall be to the Reds' machines as the bomb is to the cannon of the horse soldiers?" Travis had an inspiration. "Did not our people lay aside the bow for the rifle when we went up against the Bluecoats?"
"We do not so go up against these Reds," protested Lupi.
"Not now. But what if they come across the mountains, perhaps driving the Tatars before them to do their fighting?"
"And do you believe that if you find weapons in these towers you will know how to use them?" Jil Lee asked. "What will give you that knowledge, younger brother?"
"I do not claim such knowledge," Travis countered, "but this much I do have. Once I studied to be an archaeologist, and I have seen other storehouses of these star people. Who else among us can say as much as that?"
"That is the truth," Jil Lee acknowledged. "Also, there is good sense in seeking out of the tower things. Let the Reds find such first, if they exist at all, and then we may be truly caught in a box canyon with only death at our heels."
"And you would go to these towers now?" Nolan demanded.
"I can cut across country and then rejoin you on the other side of the pass."
The feeling of urgency which had been mounting in Travis was now so demanding that he wanted to race ahead through the wilderness. He was surprised when Jil Lee put out his palm up as if to warn the younger man.
"Take care, younger brother. This is not a lucky business. And remember, if one goes too far down a wrong trail, there is sometimes no returning."
"We shall wait on the other side of the pass for one day," Nolan added. "Then," he shrugged, "where you go will be your own affair." Travis did not understand that promise of trouble. He was already two steps down his chosen path. End of Chapter 11. Chapter 12 of The Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 12. Travis had taken a direct cross route through the heights, but not swiftly enough to reach his objective before nightfall, and he had no wish to enter the Tower Valley by moonlight. In him two emotions now warred. There was the urge to invade the towers, to discover their secret, and flaring higher and higher, the beginnings of a new fear. Was he now a battlefield for the superstitions of his race reborn by the Redax and his modern education in the Pinda Lick Oyi world, half Apache brave of the past, half modern archaeologist with a thirst for knowledge? Or was the fear rooted more deeply and for another reason? Travis crouched in a hollow, trying to understand what he felt. Why was it suddenly so overwhelmingly important for him to investigate the towers? If he only had the coyotes with him, why and where had they gone? He was alive to every noise out of the night, every scent the wind carried to him. The night had its own life, just as the daylight hours held theirs. Only a few of those sounds could he identify, even less did he see. There was one wide-winged, huge flying thing which passed across the green-gold plate of the nearer moon. It was so large that for an instant Travis believed the helicopter had come. Then the wings flapped, breaking the glide, and the creature merged in the shadows of the night, a hunter large enough to be a serious threat, and one he had never seen before. Relying on his own small defense, the strewing of brittle sticks along the only approach to the hollow, Travis dozed at intervals, his head down on his forearm across his bent knees. But the cold cramped him, and he was glad to see the graying sky of pre-dawn. He swallowed two ration tablets and a couple mouthfuls of water from his canteen and started on. By sunup, he had reached the ledge of the waterfall, and he hurried along the ancient road at a pace which increased to a run the closer he drew to the valley. Deliberately he slowed, his native caution now in control, so that he was walking as he passed through the gateway into the swirling mists which alternately exposed and veiled the towers. There was no change in the scene from the time he had come there with Kadessa. But now, rising from a comfortable sprawl on the yellow and green pavement, was a welcoming committee, Nalik Ideyu and Nagin Ulta showing no more excitement at his coming than if they had parted only moments before. Travis went down on one knee, holding out his hand to the female, who had always been the more friendly. She advanced a step or two, touched a cold nose to his knuckles, and whined. "Why?" He voiced that one word, but behind it was a long list of questions. Why had they left him? Why were they here where there was no hunting? Why did they meet him now as if they had calmly expected his return? Travis glanced from the animals to the towers, those windows set in diamond pattern. And again he was visited by the impression that he was under observation. With the mist floating across those openings, it would be easy for a lurker to watch him unseen. He walked slowly on into the valley, his moccasins making no sound on the pavement, but he could hear the faint click of the coyote's claws as they paced beside him, on each hand. The sun did not penetrate here, making merely a gilt fog of the mist. As he approached within touching distance of the first tower, it seemed to Travis that the mist was curling about him. He could no longer see the archway through which he had entered the valley.
"Naye Nezyani, Slayer of Monsters, give strength to the bow arm, to the knife wrist."
Out of what long-buried memory did that ancient plea come? Travis was hardly aware of the sense of the words until he spoke them aloud.
"You who wait, she inde toda ishan, an Apache is not food for you. I am Fox of the Itkandudandeyu, the Eagle People, and beside me walk Gaans of Power."
Travis blinked and shook his head as one waking. Why had he spoken so, using words and phrases which were not part of any modern speech? He moved on, around the base of the first tower, to find no door, no break in its surface below the second-story windows, to the next structure and the next, until he had encircled all three. If he were to enter any, he must find a way of reaching the lowest windows. On he went to the other opening of the valley, the one which gave upon the territory of the Tatar camp. But he did not sight any of the Mongols as he hacked down a sapling, trimmed and smoothed it into a blunt-pointed lance. His sash belt, torn into even strips and knotted together, gave him a rope which he judged would be barely long enough for his purpose. Then Travis made a chancy cast for the lower window of the nearest tower. On the second try the lance slipped in, and he gave a quick jerk, jamming the lance as a bar across the opening. It was a frail ladder, but the best he could improvise. He climbed until the sill of the window was within reach, and he could pull himself up and over. The sill was a wide one, at least a 24-inch span between the inner and outer surface of the tower. Travis sat there for a minute, reluctant to enter. Near the end of his dangling scarf-rope the two coyotes lay on the pavement, their heads up, their tongues lolling from their mouths, their expressions ones of detached interest. Perhaps it was the width of the outer wall that subdued the amount of light in the room. The chamber was circular, and directly opposite him was a second window, the lowest of the matching diamond pattern. He took the 4-foot drop from the sill to the floor, but lingered in the light as he surveyed every inch of the room. There were no furnishings at all, but in the very center sank a well of darkness. A smooth pillar, glowing faintly, rose from its core. Travis' adjusting eyes noted how the light came in small ripples, green and purple, over a foundation shade of dark blue. The pillar seemed rooted below, and it extended up through a similar opening in the ceiling, providing the only possible exit up or down, save for climbing from window to window outside. Travis moved slowly to the well. Underfoot was a smooth surface overlaid with a velvet carpet of dust, which arose in languid puffs as he walked. Here and there he sighted prints in the dust, strange triangular wedges which he thought might possibly have been made by the claws of birds. But there were no other footprints. This tower had been undisturbed for a long, long time. He came to the well and looked down. There was dark there, dark in which the pulsations of light from the pillar shone the stronger. But that glow did not extend beyond the edge of the well through which the thick rod threaded. Even by close examination he could detect no break in the smooth surface of the pillar, nothing remotely resembling hand or footholds. If it did serve the purpose of a staircase, there were no treads. At last Travis put out his hand to touch the surface of the pillar, and then he jerked back, to no effect. There was no breaking contact between his fingers and an unknown material, which had the sleekness of polished metal, but—and the thought made him slightly queasy—the warmth and very slight give of flesh. He summoned all his strength to pull free, and could not. Not only did that hold grip him, but his other hand and arm were being drawn to join the first. Inside Travis, primitive fears awoke full force, and he threw back his head, voicing a cry of panic as wild as that of a hunting beast. An instant later his left palm was as tight a prisoner as his right, and with both hands so held his whole body was suddenly snapped forward, off the safe foundation of the floor, tight to the pillar. In this position he was sucked down into the well, and while unable to free himself from the pillar, he did slip along its length easily enough. Travis shut his eyes in an involuntary protest against this weird form of capture, and a shiver ran through his body as he continued to descend. After the first shock had subsided, the Apache realized that he was not truly falling at all. Had the pillar been horizontal instead of vertical, he would have gauged its speed that of a walk. He passed through two more room enclosures. He must already be below the level of the valley floor outside. And he was still a prisoner of the pillar, now in total darkness. His feet came down against a level surface, and he guessed he must have reached the end. Again he pulled back, arching his shoulders in a final desperate attempt at escape, and stumbled away as he was released. He came up sideways against a wall and stood there panting. The light, which might have come from the pillar but which seemed more a part of the very air, was bright enough to reveal that he was in a corridor running into a greater dark both right and left. Travis took two strides back to the pillar, fitted his palms once again to its surface, with no result. This time his flesh did not adhere, and there was no possible way for him to climb that slick pole. He could only hope that at some point the corridor would give him access to the surface. But which way to go? At last he chose the right-hand path and started along it, pausing every few steps to listen. But there was no sound except the soft pad of his own feet. The air was fresh enough, and he thought he could detect a faint current coming toward him from some point ahead, perhaps an exit. Instead, he came into a room, and a small gasp of astonishment was wrung out of him. The walls were blank, covered with the same ripples of blue-purple-green light which colored the pillar. Just before him was a table, and behind it a bench, both carved from the native yellow-red mountain rock. And there was no exit except the doorway in which he now stood. Travis walked to the bench. Immovable, it was placed so that whoever sat there must face the opposite wall of the chamber with the table before him. And on the table was an object Travis recognized immediately from his voyage in the alien starship, one of the reader-viewers through which the involuntary explorers had learned what little they knew of the older galactic civilization. A reader, and beside it a box of tapes. Travis touched the edge of that box gingerly, half expecting it to crumble into nothingness. This was a place long deserted. Stone table, bench, the towers could survive through centuries of abandonment. But these other objects... The substance of the reader was firm under the film of dust. There was less dust here than it had been in the upper tower chamber. Hardly knowing why, Travis threw one leg over the bench and sat down behind the table, the reader before him, the box of tapes just beyond his hand. He surveyed the walls and then looked away hurriedly. The rippling colors caught at his eyes. He had a feeling that if he watched that ebb and flow too long, he would be captured in some subtle web of enchantment just as the Reds machine had caught and held the Tatars. He turned his attention to the reader. It was, he believed, much like the one they had used on the ship. This room, table, bench, had all been designed with a set purpose. And that purpose, Travis' fingers rested on the box of tapes he could not yet bring himself to open, that purpose was to use the reader. He would swear to that. Tape, so left, must have had a great importance for those who left them. It was as if the whole valley was a trap to channel a stranger into this underground chamber. Travis snapped open the box, fed the first disk into the reader, and applied his eyes to the vision tube at its apex. The rippling walls looked just the same when he looked up once more, but the cramp in his muscles told Travis that time had passed, perhaps hours instead of minutes, since he had taken out the first disk. He cupped his hands over his eyes and tried to think clearly. There had been sheets of meaningless symbol writing, but also there had been many clear three-dimensional pictures, accompanied by a sing-song commentary in an alien tongue, seemingly voiced out of thin air. He had been stuffed with ragged bits and patches of information, to be connected only by guesses, and some wild guesses too. But this much he did know. These towers had been built by the bald spacemen, and they were highly important to that vanished stellar civilization. The information in this room, as disjointed as it had been for him, led to a treasure trove on Topaz greater than he had dreamed. Travis swayed on the bench. To know so much and yet so little. If Ash were only here, or some other of the project technicians. A treasure such as Pandora's box had been, peril for one who opened it and did not understand. The Apache studied the three walls of blue, purple, green in turn and with new attention. There were ways through those walls. He was fairly sure he could unlock at least one of them. But not now, certainly not now. And there was another thing he knew. The Reds must not find this. Such a discovery on their part would not only mean the end of his own people on Topaz, but the end of Terra as well. This could be a new and alien Black Death spread to destroy whole nations at a time. If he could, much as his archaeologist training would argue against it, he would blot out this whole valley, above and below ground. But while the Reds might possess a means of such destruction, the Apaches did not. No, he and his people must prevent its discovery by the enemy by doing what he had seen as necessary from the first, wiping out the Red leaders. And that must be done before they chanced upon the towers. Travis arose stiffly. His eyes ached, his head felt stuffed with pictures, hints, speculations. He wanted to get out, back into the open air, where perhaps the clean winds of the heights would blow some of this frightening half-knowledge from his benumbed mind. He lurched down the corridor, puzzled now by the problem of getting back to the window level. Here before him was the pillar. Without hope, but still obeying some buried instinct, Travis again set his hands to its surface. There was a tug at his cramped arms. Once more his body was sucked to the pillar. This time he was rising. He held his breath past the first level and then relaxed. The principle of this weird form of transportation was entirely beyond his understanding, but as long as it worked in reverse he didn't care to find out. He reached the windowed chamber, but the sunlight had left it. Instead, the clean cut of moonsweep lay on the dusty floor. He must have been hours in that underground place. Travis pulled away from the embrace of the pillar. The bar of his wooden lance was still across the window, and he ran for it. To catch the scouting party at the pass, he must hurry. The report they would have to make to the clan now had to be changed radically in the face of his new discoveries. The Apaches dared not retreat southward and withdraw from the fight, leaving the Reds to use what treasure lay here. As he hit the pavement below, he looked about for the coyotes. Then he tried the mind call. But as mysteriously as they had met him in the valley, so now were they gone again, and Travis had no time to hunt for them. With a sigh, he began to race to the pass. In the old days, Travis remembered, Apache warriors had been able to cover 45 or 50 miles a day on foot and over rough territory. But perhaps his modern breeding had slowed him. He had been so sure he could catch up before the others were through the pass. But he stood now in the hollow where they had camped, read the sign of an overturned stone and bent twig left for him, and knew they would reach the rancheria and report the decision Declay and the others wanted before he could head them off. Travis slogged on. He was so tired now that only the drug from the sustenance tablets he mouthed at intervals kept him going at a dogged pace, hardly more than a swift walk. And always his mind was haunted by fragments of pictures. Pictures he had seen in the reader. The big bomb had been the nightmare of his own world for so long, and what was that against the forces the bald star rovers had been able to command? He fell beside a stream and slept. There was sunshine about him as he arose to stagger on. What day was this? How long had he sat in the tower chamber? He was not sure of time anymore. He only knew that he must reach the rancheria, tell his story, somehow win over Declay and the other reactionaries to prove the necessity for invading the North in force. A rocky point which was a familiar landmark came into focus. He padded on, his chest heaving, his breath whistling through parched, sun-cracked lips. He did not know that his face was now a mask of driven resolution.
"Ha!"
The cry reached his dulled ears. Travis lifted his head, saw the men before him, and tried to think what that show of weapons turned toward him could mean. A stone thudded to earth only inches before his feet, to be followed by another. He wavered to a stop.
"Ne-ilgak!"
"Witch? Where was a witch?" Travis shook his head. There was no witch.
"Donne ilka da!"
The old death threat. But why? For whom? Another stone, this one hitting him in the ribs with force enough to send him reeling back and down. He tried to get up again, saw Declay grin widely and take aim. And at last Travis realized what was happening. Then there was a bursting pain in his head and he was falling, falling into a well of black. This time with no pillar of blue to guide him. End of chapter 12. Chapter 13 of The Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 13. the rasp of something wet and rough persistent against his cheek. Travis tried to turn his head to avoid the contact, and was answered by a burst of pain which trailed off into a giddiness, making him fear another move, no matter how minor. He opened his eyes and saw the pointed ears, the outline of a coyote head between him and a dull gray sky, was able to recognize Nalik Ideyu. A wetness other than that from the coyote's tongue slid down his forehead now. The dull clouds overhead had released the first heavy rain Travis had experienced since their landing on Topaz. He shivered as the chill damp of his clothes made him aware that he must have been lying out in the full force of the downpour for some time. It was a struggle to get to his knees, but Nalik Ideyu mouthed a hold on his shirt, tugging and pulling so that, somehow, he crept into a hollow beneath the branches of a tree, where the spouting water was lessened to a few pattering drops. There the Apache's strength deserted him again, and he could only hunch over, his bent knees against his chest, trying to endure the throbbing misery in his head, the awful floating sensation which followed any movement. Fighting against that, he tried to remember just what had happened. The meeting with Deklay and at least four or five others. Then the Apache accusation of witchcraft, a serious thing in the old days. Old days. To Deklay and his followers, these were the old days. And the threat of that Deklay or some other had shouted at him, "Do ni ilka da," meant literally, "It won't dawn for you, death." Stones, the last thing Travis remembered, were the stones. Slowly, his hands went out to explore his body. There was more than one bruised area on his shoulders and ribs, even on his thighs. He must still have been a target after he had fallen under the stone which had knocked him unconscious. Stoned, outlawed. But why? Surely Deklay's hostility could not have swept Buck, Jill Lee, Tsoe, even Nolan, into agreeing to that. Now he could not think straight. Travis became aware of warmth, not only of warmth and the soft touch of a furred body by his side, but a comforting communication of mind, a feeling he had no words to describe adequately. Nalik Ideyu was sitting crowded against him, her nose thrust up to rest on his shoulder. She breathed in soft puffs, which stirred the loose locks of his rain-damp hair. And now he flung one arm about her, a gesture which brought a whisper of answering whine. He was past wondering about the actions of the coyotes, only supremely thankful for Nalik Ideyu's present companionship. And a moment later, when her mate squeezed under the low loop of a branch and joined them in his natural wickiup, Travis held out his other hand, drew it lovingly across Nagan Ulto's wet hide. "Now what?" he asked aloud. Deklay could only have taken such a drastic action with the majority of the clan solidly behind him. It could well be that this reactionary was the new chief, this act of Travis' expulsion merely adding to Deklay's growing prestige. The shivering, which had begun when Travis recovered consciousness, still shook him at intervals. Back on Terra, like all the others in the team, he had had every inoculation known to the space physicians, including several experimental ones. But the cold virus could still practically immobilize a man, and this was no time to give body room to chills and fever. Catching his breath as his movements touched to life the pain in one bruise after another, Travis peeled off his soaked clothing, rubbed his body dry with handfuls of last year's leaves culled from the thick carpet under him, knowing there was nothing he could do until the whirling in his head disappeared. So he burrowed into the leaves until only his head was uncovered, and tried to sleep, the coyotes curling up one on either side of his nest. He dreamed, but later could not remember any incident from those dreams, save a certain frustration and fear. When he awoke, again to the sound of steady rain, it was dark. He reached out, both coyotes were gone. His head was clearer, and suddenly he knew what must be done. As soon as his body was strong enough, he too would return to instincts and customs of the past. This situation was desperate enough for him to challenge Deklay. In the dark, Travis frowned. He was slightly taller and 3 or 4 years younger than his enemy. But Deklay had the advantage in a stouter build and longer reach. However, Travis was sure that in his present life Deklay had never fought a duel Apache fashion. And an Apache duel was not a meeting anyone entered into lightly. Travis had the right to enter the rancheria and deliver such a challenge. Then Deklay must meet him or admit himself in the wrong. That part of it was simple. But in the past, such duels had just one end, a fatal one for at least one of the fighters. If Travis took this trail, he must be prepared to go the limit. And he didn't want to kill Deklay. There were too few of them here on Topaz to make any loss less than a real catastrophe. While he had no liking for Deklay, neither did he nurse any hatred. However, he must challenge the other or remain a tribal outcast, and Travis had no right to gamble with time and the future, not after what he had learned in the tower. It might be his life and skill, or Deklay's, against the blotting out of them all, and their homeworld into the bargain. First, he must locate the present camp of the clan. If Nolan's arguments had counted, they would be heading south away from the pass. And to follow would draw him farther from the Tower Valley. Travis' battered face ached as he grinned bitterly. This was another time when a man could wish he were two people, a scout on sentry duty at the valley, the fighter heading in the opposite direction to have it out with Deklay. But since he was merely one man, he would have to gamble on time, one of the trickiest risks of all. Before dawn, Nalik Ideyu returned, carrying with her a bird, or at least birds must have been somewhere in the creature's ancestry, but the present representative of its kind had only vestigial remnants of wings, its trailing feet and legs well developed and far more powerful. Travis skinned the corpse, automatically putting aside some spine quills to feather future arrows. Then he ate slivers of dusky meat raw, throwing the bones to Nalik Ideyu. Though he was still stiff and sore, Travis was determined to be on his way. He tried mind contact with the coyote, picturing the Apaches, notably Deklay, as sharply as he could by mental image. And her assent was clear in return. She and her mate were willing to lead him to the tribe. He gave a light sigh of relief. As he slogged on through the depressing drizzle, the Apache wondered again why the coyotes had left him before and waited in the Tower Valley. What link was there between the animals of Terra and the remains of the long-ago Empire of the Stars? For he was certain it was not by chance that Nalik Ideyu and Nagan Ulta had lingered in that misty place. He longed to communicate with them directly, to ask questions, and be answered. Without their aid, Travis would never have been able to track the clan. The drizzle alternated with slashing bursts of rain, torrential enough to drive the trackers to the nearest cover. Overhead, the sky was either dull bronze or night black. Even the coyotes paced nose to the ground, often making wide casts for the trail while Travis waited. The rain lasted for 3 days and nights, filling watercourses with rapidly rising streams. Travis could only hope that the others were having the same difficulty traveling that he was, perhaps the more so since they were burdened with packs. The fact that they kept on meant that they were determined to get as far from the northern mountains as they could. On the fourth morning, the bronze of the clouds slowly thinned into the usual gold, and sun struck across hills where mist curled like steam from 100 bubbling pots. Travis relaxed in the welcome warmth, feeling his shirt dry on his shoulders. It was still a waterlogged terrain ahead which should continue to slow the clan. He had high expectations of catching up with them soon, and now the worst of his bruises had faded. His muscles were limber, and he had worked out his plan as best he could. 2 hours later, he sat in ambush, waiting for the scout who was walking into his hands. Under the direction of the coyotes, Travis had circled the line of march, come in ahead of the clan. Now he needed an emissary to state his challenge, and the fact that the scout he was about to jump was Manolito, one of Deklay's supporters, suited Travis' purpose perfectly. He gathered his feet under him as the other came opposite and sprang. The rush carried Manolito off his feet and face down on the sod, while Travis made the best of his advantage and pinned the wildly fighting man under him. Had it been one of the older braves, he might not have been so successful, but Manolito was still a boy by Apache standards.
"Lie still," Travis ordered. "Listen well, so you can say to Deklay the words of the fox."
The frenzied struggle ceased. Manolito managed to wrench his head to the left so he could see his captor. Travis loosened his grip, got to his feet. Manolito sat up, his face darkly sullen, but he did not reach for his knife.
"You will say this to Deklay. The fox says he is a man of little sense and less courage, preferring to throw stones rather than meet knife to knife as does a warrior. If he thinks as a warrior, let him prove it. His strength against my strength, after the ways of the people."
Some of the sullenness left Manolito's expression. He was eager, excited.
"You would duel with Deklay after the old custom?"
"I would. Say this to Deklay, openly, so that all men may hear. Then Deklay must also give answer openly."
Manolito flushed at the implication concerning his leader's courage, and Travis knew that he would deliver the challenge openly. To keep his hold on the clan, the latter must accept it, and there would be an audience of his people to witness the success or defeat of their new chief and his policies. As Manolito disappeared, Travis summoned the coyotes, putting full effort into getting across one message. Any tribe led by Deklay would be hostile to the mutant animals. They must go into hiding, run free in the wilderness, if the gamble failed Travis. Now they withdrew into the bushes, but not out of reach of his mind. He did not have too long to wait. First came Jill Lee, Buck, Nolan, Tsoe, Lupi, those who had been with him on the Northern Scout. Then the others, the warriors first, the women making a half-circle behind, leaving a free space in which Deklay walked.
"I am the fox," Travis stated, "and this one has named me witch and Natahi, outlaw of the mountains. Therefore do I come to name names in my turn. Hear me, people. This Deklay, he would walk among you as Izes-Nantan, a great chief, but he does not have the Go'undi, the holy power of a chief. For this Deklay is a fool, with a head filled by nothing but his own wishes, not caring for his clan brothers. He says he leads you into safety. I say he leads you into the worst danger any living man can imagine, even in peyote dreams. He is one twisted in his thoughts, and he would make you twisted also."
Buck cut in sharply, hushing the murmur of the masked clan.
"These are bold words, Fox. Will you back them?"
Travis' hands were already peeling off his shirt.
"I will back them," he stated between set teeth.
He had known since his awakening after the stoning that this next move was the only one left for him to make. But now that the testing of his action came, he could not be certain of the outcome, of anything save that the final decision of this battle might affect more than the fate of two men. He stripped, noting that Deklay was doing the same. Having stepped into the center of the glade, Nolan was using the point of his knife to score a deep ridge circle there. Naked except for his moccasins, with only his knife in his hand, Travis took the two strides which put him in the circle facing Deklay. He surveyed his opponent's finely muscled body, realizing that his earlier estimate of Deklay's probable advantages were close to the mark. In sheer strength, the other outmatched him. Whether Deklay was skillful with his knife was another question, one which Travis would soon be able to answer. They circled, eyes intent upon each move, striving to weigh and measure each other's strengths and weaknesses. Knife-dueling among the Pindalik Oyi, Travis remembered, had once been an art close to finished swordplay, with two evenly matched fighters able to engage for a long time without seriously marking each other. But this was a far rougher and more deadly game, with none of the niceties of such a meeting. He evaded a vicious thrust from Deklay.
"The bull charges," he laughed, "and the fox snaps."
By some incredible stroke of good fortune, the point of his weapon actually grazed Deklay's arm, drawing a thin, red, inch-long line across the skin.
"Charge again, bull! Feel once more the fox's teeth!"
He strove to goad Deklay into a crippling loss of temper, knowing how the other could explode into violent rage. It was dangerous, that rage, but it could also make a man blindly careless. There was an inarticulate sound from Deklay, a dusky swelling in the man's face. He spat, as might an enraged puma, and rushed at Travis, who did not quite manage to avoid the lunge, falling back with a smarting slash across the ribs.
"The bull gores!" Deklay bellowed. "Horns toss the fox!"
He rushed again, elated by the sight of the trickling wound on Travis' side, but the slighter man slipped away. Travis knew he must be careful in such evasions. One foot across the ridge circle, and he was finished, as much as if Deklay's blade had found its mark. Travis tried a thrust of his own, and his foot came down hard on a sharp pebble. Through the sole of his moccasin, pain shot upward, causing him to stumble. Again the scarlet flame of a wound down his shoulder and forearm this time. Well, there was one trick he knew. Travis tossed the knife into the air, caught it with his left hand. Deklay was now facing a left-handed fighter and must adjust to that.
"Paw, bull, rattle your horns!" Travis cried. "The fox still shows his teeth!"
Deklay recovered from his instant of surprise. With a cry which was indeed like the bellow of an old range bull, he rushed into grapple, sure of his superior strength against a younger and already wounded man. Travis ducked, one knee thumping the ground. He groped out with his right hand, caught up a handful of earth, and flung it into the dusky brown face. Again it seemed that luck was on his side. That handful could not be as blinding as sand, but some bit of the shower landed in Deklay's eye. For a space of seconds Deklay was wide open, open for a blow which would rip him up the middle, the blow Travis could not and would not deliver. Instead, he took the offensive recklessly, springing straight for his opponent. As the earth-grimed fingers of one hand clawed into Deklay's face, he struck with the other, not with the point of the knife, but with its shaft. But Deklay, already only half-conscious from the blow, had his own chance. He fell to the ground, leaving his knife behind, 2 inches of steel between Travis' ribs. Somehow, he didn't know from where he drew that strength, Travis kept his feet and took one step and then another out of the circle, until the comforting brace of a tree trunk was against his bare back. Was he finished? He fought to nurse his rags of consciousness. Had he summoned Buck with his eyes? Or had the urgency of what he had to say reached somehow from mind to mind? The other was at his side, but Travis put out a hand to ward him off.
"Towers!"
He struggled to keep his wits through the pain and billowing weakness beginning to creep through him.
"Reds mustn't get to the towers! Worse than the bomb! End us all!"
He had a hazy glimpse of Nolan and Jill Lee closing in about him. The desire to cough tore at him, but they had to know, to believe.
"Reds get to the towers. Everything finished. Not only here, maybe back home, too."
Did he read comprehension on Buck's face? Would Nolan and Jill Lee and the rest believe him? Travis could not suppress the cough any longer, and the ripping pain which followed was the worst he had ever experienced. But still he kept his feet, tried to make them understand.
Don't let them get to the towers. Find that storehouse.
Travis stood away from the tree, reached out to Buck his earth and blood-stained hand.
I swear, truth, this must be done.
He was going down, and he had a queer thought that once he reached the ground, everything would end, not only for him, but also for his mission. Trying to see the faces of the men about him was like attempting to identify the people in a dream.
Towers!
He had meant to shout it, but he could not even hear for himself that last word as he fell. End of chapter 13.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.